Welcome to Ancient Future Faith with Dr. Chris Alford, pastor of Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community in Sacramento. Just what is ancient future Christian faith? Join Chris each week as he talks with special guests about a refreshing renewal in evangelical worship and spirituality that's helping many believers get in touch with their ancient Christian heritage. Now, with another look at how the road to the evangelical future runs through the ancient past, here's Dr. Chris Alford.
Well, folks, I can't tell you how terrific it is to have you for another episode of Ancient Future Faith. We talk about all kinds of things on this podcast, and it's a ministry of Epiclesis, an Ancient Future Faith church in Sacramento, California. For the last couple of months or so, I've had a wonderful guest right here in the studio with me to talk about, well, lots of stuff, genealogy and plagues and all kinds of things. And back for a third conversation, and more about the other two in a minute, is my buddy and author, William Bill Cole. Bill, hey, and welcome back.
Hey, thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
So 10 years ago, did you ever think that you'd be talking about, I don't know, plagues? And
I did not. I did not have a clue about any of that stuff. In fact, I didn't even know anything about English history.
Yeah, well, we're talking, folks, about an amazing research project that Bill undertook, and I guess is still uncovering nuggets of gems of things along the way. But it's about his family and their amazing start in a little bitty village called Wedenbeck back in the day, and it's about your ancestors. Bill, if folks want to get caught up with what we've talked about before, we should send them over to the website. It's epiclesis.org, E-P-I-C-L-E-S-I-S.org. Just click on podcasts and you can search there for Bill or the title of the book, which is
Puritans, Plagues, and Promises. And this is the third podcast right. We will add. So if you want to learn a little bit more about Puritans and what their issues were that happened some 30 years before the Mayflower, my ancestor and his vicar were heavily involved in the Puritan movement.
Boy, they sure were. And along the way, got caught up in a lot of political intrigue and
trials and tribulations.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They were in the Star Chamber testifying in London.
And folks, I really want to encourage you to zip over there and check those podcasts out. Bill, I told you before we started recording that I was going to surprise you with the numbers. It turns out that the first podcast we did now has over 200 folks who have listened to it.
Wow.
The second one is just over 100 and counting. And I don't doubt that this one as well is going to get a lot of hits because, among other things, we're going to finally get your ancestors from England to America and aboard one of the most famous ships that ever sailed.
That's correct. Some a little ship called the Mayflower.
I suppose, though, we ought to just say where we've been in a little recap, a little quick recap. You had an ancestor named Cole, and mm-hmm. he lived in a little town called Wedenbeck. He gets swept up in the reforms that mm-hmm. the Puritans, as they were called then, although they had a lot of different stripes, as I understand it, wanted to undertake. And then parts of the family find their way and are surfacing in London, mm-hmm. and they get involved in, gosh, fires and plagues. Give us sort of an overview of where we are thus far, would you?
The Puritan movement part focused in the early 1590s, and this was an era when there were independent churches forming that were primarily underground churches in London. There were 11 of them. And this vicar from the little town of Wedenbeck, William Proudlove.
Oh, little town of Wedenbeck. Let's make a good Christmas carol.
Yeah, that's good. Let's make one. William Proudlove gets himself embroiled and arrested and put on trial in London. So obviously, that's a pretty big deal historically.
And now, he was not your ancestor, but your ancestor was very much involved in the life of the church and helping the vicar.
That's right. My ancestor was one of the six church wardens in Wedenbeck. And basically, the entire parish church stopped attending the church when William Proudlove, their vicar, was arrested and sent to London. And for a period of 4 years, they were, in essence, shutting down the church.
Because they stood with him.
That's right, absolutely.
Even though that could mean, well, and in fact for some of them it did, a kind of inquisition.
Yes. And then what happens is after the trials come to a stalemate, there's a plague. And there's a plague in London that's devastating. And that's when they decide to let the 9 Puritans on trial in the Star Chamber in front of the High Commission. They release them to go back to their homes. They didn't absolve them of anything, but they didn't convict them of anything either. So it was truly a stalemate. So they were told to go home and wait and get out of the plague area. So at that point in time, my ancestors get involved in additional work and additional movement, and some of them surface in the south bank side of the River Thames.
Yes.
In metropolitan London, which is called Southwark.
Yes.
Southwark was a major town of, oh, let's say cloth merchants, grocers, all sorts of industry, but it also had kind of an underbelly side. It was the area where they had blood sports that had originally been sponsored by the church to raise money.
Good heavens, I had no idea.
Yeah, bull and bear baiting and chicken fights.
To raise money for the church?
Yeah, absolutely, that's how it started. But when...
Okay, hold on, my mind is spinning with possibilities.
Heck of a ways to raise money, right?
In case we get a little behind in the budget.
Yeah, yeah.
So your ancestors of various sides are at work and busy in the life of Southwark. If folks who are familiar at least a little bit with London, if you were to go to the Tower of London, the infamous and famous Tower of London, cross the Tower Bridge going to the south, you end up in Southwark.
Right.
And all kinds of notorious prisons and whatnot. Bill, last time we got together, we were also talking about fires, and there were...
Well, yeah, several.
Several fires, several plagues, and one matriarch of your family survives all of it.
Yes.
She should be the new unsinkable Molly Brown. Tell us a little bit about her and what she overcame.
Yes, Jane Yates, who was born in 1587, survived a major plague in 1593, where most of the family died except for her, her mother, and 2 other children. 8 other children died in that particular plague, and the father of Jane died.
Right.
She survives, marries then at the age of 16, a man by the name of Thomas Clark. And they have a lovely family, and Thomas Clark is a dyer. He's a cloth merchant trading with the Dutch. So that's one of the major trades that occurs in the area of Southwark. Unfortunately, another plague hits, and he dies, and Jane's 4th child dies, but three children and Jane survive that plague, which was in 1610. What that leads to is she marries a second time a man by the name of William Collier, and William Collier is a major figure in the book.
Now, we should say what he was up to, because that's where we start to get connections with coming to the New World, right?
That's correct.
But before we do that, let me just remind folks that they're listening to a wonderful conversation with Bill Cole. He's talking about his book, his research, and this is the 3rd of 3 podcasts where we've talked about his amazing family and the roots and the important roles that they played, not only in religion and church reform, but also with regard to adventure and settling in the New World. Mm-hmm. And we are now to the point where we're in Southwark, and we're talking about a collier.
Right.
Bill, how is he related to you? Let's just make sure we're up to date on that.
He is my 9th great-grandfather, and his wife, who was Jane Clark when he married her, her second marriage, Jane and William are my 9th great-grandparents.
Now, what in the world does he have to do with Puritans or pilgrims or adventures or that kind of thing.
Yes. Well, in the first place, Suffolk is a hotbed of Puritanism. And in fact, there is one church that's still active today that can trace back to the 1590s when Proudlove was visiting Suffolk.
And we remember that Proudlove is the vicar.
The vicar of Weedon Beck.
Where your coal ancestor got this whole thing started.
Right. But in Suffolk, there were underground churches that were operating outside of the purview of the Church of England. The Church of England tolerated them, but occasionally would raid them in a worship service and put people in prison. That's where Collier lived. And so his parish and the parishes adjacent to him had much in the way of the same philosophy of worship that the people who ended up on the Mayflower did as well.
Well, just sketch that out for us. What is their driving force in worship? What are they reacting against? What are they for, etc.?
The major things that they were for, number one, was allowing a vicar to go beyond the Book of Common Prayer. Rather than just reading Scripture, they were able to elaborate on the Scripture in what we would call a sermon today.
Because before that, all they could do was stick to the Book of Common Prayer without any commentary whatsoever.
Exactly.
There was also something about small groups, what we would call small groups.
The Puritans were known for forming what we would call small group Bible studies. And those Bible studies would be done sometimes under the purview of the vicar participating, and sometimes even they would bless other congregants to get together and discuss a sermon and the appropriate Bible passage sometime during the week before they would come back to worship the following week.
Let's try to put ourselves in the place of the Anglican Church, though, Church of England.
Right.
Why would they have not wanted people to do that? It isn't necessarily all nefarious.
It's not. And in fact, the Church of England was trying to control the quality of what was happening. Because at that time, particularly in small towns throughout England, there weren't enough ministers to serve all of the congregations. So ministers would end up serving multiple congregations, and sometimes they would be forced to appoint people who did not have all of the university training necessary to be a good pastor.
And why did they want to control what was being said in a Bible study?
Well,
I got a stab at that.
You might answer that better than me.
Well, the principal reason is, because at least this is the ostensible reason, is because they cared very much about, quote, appropriate and legitimate interpretation of Scripture.
Absolutely.
So they were afraid that people would get in there and start all sorts of heretical stuff.
Right. I think there were other reforms that the Puritans were trying to bring forward. They were trying to push back against too many remnants of Catholic liturgy and vestments that were associated with that.
Right.
They were against that because they could not find any scriptural basis for some of those things. So there were those kind of elements as well. They were also trying to influence the management structure of the Church of England. Instead of being so top down through bishops, through hierarchical means, they wanted to have more local input as well to what was happening. Even to have input in accepting a minister, a pastor, a vicar that was assigned to them.
Right. So Collier is in the middle of this whole milieu,
mm-hmm.
and
he's a normal guy, though, because he's a merchant.
He's a businessman.
Yeah, he's a businessman. He's what's called a grocer. Think of a grocery store. That's someone who wholesales a commodity or a product. Now, at that time in Suffolk, the two major trades were anything related to cloth and clothing,
mm-hmm.
and exporting of that, but also importing of spices. Mm. My suspicion is he was a little bit involved in both of those.
He's a person of means, right?
Well, he becomes a person of means because he's a successful grocer. And you can tell that by the children that he and Jane, his wife, had, because they married in 1611, and by 1620, they had like 8 children in the household and a servant.
Poor Jane.
Oh, remember she had four children from her first marriage, and then she has like eight immediately, some of them almost to the day from the date of their marriage, 9 months later, and then a year after that.
So she not only survives about three plagues and 14 fires.
She's very fertile.
She survived I don't know how many pregnancies.
Well, total of 17 ultimately.
Mercy.
Oh, my goodness.
Reminds me of J.S. Bach.
Yeah.
Hey, what is his now connection to the whole adventure relating to going to the New World, and why'd they want to do it?
Well, because he was a successful merchant, the folks that became the investor group were actually started by a person in his neighborhood, a man by the name of Thomas Weston. And he had met and interacted with the Leiden separatists, the Pilgrims of the Mayflower. That's what we know them as. But they were separatists who left England in 1607, 1608. They initially went to Amsterdam. There were three congregations that combined in Amsterdam in the late 1608-09 era. They split up because the three pastors couldn't agree on the worship. Sound familiar?
And, oh, there's nothing new under the sun.
And so that particular group ended up in the little town of Leiden in the Netherlands. That was a core group from about 1612 to 1619.
And this is how Collier sort of gets caught up in this opportunity.
I don't know the exact how he started, but he is quoted as having been an investor of the people that became the Mayflower from the beginning, which means he was one of the initial people recruited, probably because he lived in the same area. He was a successful merchant. And Thomas Weston would have known of him and asked him to put some money into the deal.
I see.
That's how it worked.
Presumably, he would not do so if he didn't identify with their aims.
Absolutely. And that's why Suffolk was such a fertile ground. And you can see there were several investors that put up money to buy in. At that time, it was, I believe, £10 for one share. Some people invested as much as today's equivalent of thousands and thousands of dollars, and there were many small investors, but there were about 70 people who formed an investor group under Thomas Weston, who then came to Leiden in 1620 in the spring and made a proposal to the folks there, because he knew they were looking to leave Leiden, and their best option to worship as they pleased was the virgin continent of America.
Let's hold there a minute. Remind folks that they're listening to a conversation with William Bill Cole. We're talking about a book of his that has to do with, golly, all kinds of things. And we'll talk about that in just a second. Even if you're not, say, all that interested in genealogy, this is part of the story of America, and it has roots in religious freedom and, well, all kinds of other things. Mm-hmm. Bill, I'm going to put you on the spot, and forgive me for not asking you ahead of time, but I think most people may not realize that this whole adventure was a kind of investment. It required backers.
Yes.
And what is it they're investing in? I mean, because surely they don't want to just throw their money away. Right. They expect some sort of return. How did all the financial part of it work?
Well, that was interesting, because what the proposal was that Thomas Weston made to the Pilgrims, who became the Pilgrims, actually, was that the investor group would agree to support a voyage to America. They would contract the ship. They'd contract the captain. They would also put the supplies in enough so that they would have food when they came to their new promised land, if you will.
Right.
So they put together this whole package. And what they agreed to initially was that the colonists in America would work 4 days a week for the company producing goods such as fishing, such as lumber, such as fur trapping, all of those commodities, in essence, that frankly they were aware of in America as early as the early 1500s.
How so?
Well, because there were fishing trawlers from England went to Newfoundland and discovered cod.
Right.
And cod was an incredible resource for fish, which could be transported by salting them, etc. Mm-hmm. So there became a trade in all that. And right off of Cape Cod in America is a huge area that is the primary source of cod fishing in the world.
So these people want some religious freedom. They mm-hmm. want to worship as they choose. And here's a way to finance it. But, I mean, they have to do something in return.
Yeah, yeah, they have to work 4 days a week for the company. And the initial proposal was they could work 2 days a week on their own and then have Sabbath off. But the deal fell apart.
Because
they agreed on that deal in Leiden. Thomas Weston went back to the whole investor group saying, we have a deal. And some of the investors said, oh, there's too much risk. So they changed the deal. So the first promise was broken. And they then came back after the Mayflower had been contracted and the separatists in Leiden had sold their stuff, and they got another ship called the Speedwell to right. meet up with the London folks. And they didn't know the deal wasn't accepted until they got to Southampton and Thomas Weston was standing on the pier informing them, by the way, that deal we had, it's not going to work that way. You got to work 6 days a week for the company.
Oh,
and
wow.
instead of being able to own your property at the end of 7 years, in other words, they were going to make their own homes and have property, but instead of owning it at the end of 7 years, you'd only own half of it.
Holy smokes.
Oh, man, there was a blow up
I'm sure.
on the pier.
They could not have agreed to that, did they?
No, they didn't. The thing was, they had told their representative, Robert Cushman, to turn down the deal. Well, Cushman was afraid to tell the investors for fear they would back out, so he didn't tell them.
Mm. Is Weston the bad guy in this?
Yeah, kinda. But if it wasn't for him, it would have never started.
Indeed. So what happens with the deal? Where do we go now?
Well, the Pilgrim folks on the Speedwell had brought supplies with them. They had a lot of butter in their hold that they were going to take to America. They sold a bunch of it to be able to pay for the other stuff that Weston wasn't going to provide. He stomped off the pier, and basically they sold enough stuff to be able to continue the voyage. Now, here is where you have something very interesting going on, because you have the people who left from London on the Mayflower ship who weren't even the Pilgrim folks. They were recruited by people like William Collier and Thomas Weston and that whole investor group, but they wouldn't recruit people who would agree to go to America unless they were like-minded worshipers.
And why were they recruited?
Because part of the Leiden group, when they found out how difficult the voyage might be and how difficult life might be, only part of them decided to go on the initial voyage.
I see.
So some people held back, including their minister, who was going to stay with his flock at that point in time and come over later, John Robinson.
So do both ships go at the same time?
Yeah. One ship leaves from Leiden and goes to Southampton, which is on, that's on the English Channel.
Mm-hmm.
And the London ship comes down and they meet in Southampton. So okay. after they kind of settle up that they're going to agree to go on the voyage, both ships leave. They only get 75 miles out in the English Channel. And the Speedwell springs a leak.
I think I remember that story.
Okay, yeah. So they have to go into port again at Dartmouth.
Yes.
They do repairs. Both ships leave again. They go 300 miles out into the beginning of the Atlantic Ocean. And guess what? Speedwell again has another leak. And at that point, they say, no more. We're going back to the port. And they end up in Plymouth.
Plymouth,
England.
Right.
Okay, which is on kind of the tip going towards America.
Right.
So now you have these two ships everybody on the Speedwell, about 20 of the colonists, said, we've had enough, we're going home. So they took the Speedwell back home, which was London at that point, and everybody went to London that wasn't going on to America, and 102 people crammed on the Mayflower in Plymouth.
Mercy.
Now, Chris, what's important about this story is they started the trip, both groups started the trip in mid-July, and by the time they left Plymouth on the one ship, the Mayflower, it was already September 6th.
Shades of the Donner Party.
Exactly, because that put them into hurricane season,
right?
And there were some pretty difficult times on the trip.
Now, who on board the Mayflower is your ancestor or
yes,
ancestors?
I actually have two ancestors on the Mayflower, a man by the name of Stephen Hopkins and his daughter Constance, who was 14 years old. And what's interesting about Stephen Hopkins is he was the only passenger on the Mayflower who had been to America before.
All right, before you get to that story, though, I want to make sure I've got the genealogy right in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Are these people related to Collier?
Actually, the real connection is with Collier's final daughter, Jane's 17th birth, which was Ruth Collier, who married my ancestor, Daniel Cole. So the Cole descendants are connected to Constance Hopkins, who is Stephen Hopkins' daughter.
Okay, so does this mean that you have connections to the Mayflower and the adventure of it and the investment in it from two different?
Yes, from two different sides. And that's what makes the book also interesting, is because I'm able to address both sides of the equation, what the investors were thinking and what the passengers were thinking. And that dynamic, I don't think, has been fully understood very well in previous publications.
I'm still trying to wrap my brain around this, though. Collier would not have known them because the connections to them were sometime in the future.
Collier's apprentice in Suffolk was the brother of Daniel Cole, Job Cole.
I see.
So Job Cole actually ended up marrying one of Collier's daughters.
So they know each other.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, he knew all of the family. He actually knew four of the Cole brothers in Suffolk.
What an adventure. So we say goodbye to Mr. Collier.
Yeah.
By the way, did he support any other future missions, or what becomes of him and Jane?
What becomes of them after the last London Bridge fire in 1633, they say we've had enough, and that's one of the final straws for them to decide they're going to America and join the Plymouth colonists.
Oh. Okay, so we got to circle back to that at some point.
Yeah.
And they do that.
And William Collier becomes one of the most important administrators in Plymouth Colony. He was elected to be assistant governor 28 times after he arrived. Only one or two other people served more than that.
All right, my brain is hurting because I'm trying to keep two bits of story going at the same time. Let's put aside the Colliers for a moment. And now we're aboard a super cramped and rocky and stormy voyage on the Mayflower, where the other part of your family, a man and his daughter, are traveling to the New World.
You know, there's a particularly good piece of that that I'd like to share directly out of the book.
Yeah.
When you think about these people who are leaving for America, they had probably never been on a ship before. And so William Bradford, who became the most prominent governor of the Plymouth Colony, he wrote down this little story, and I'm quoting William Bradford. "And I may not omit here a special work of God's providence. There was a proud and very profane young man, one of the seamen, of a lusty, able body, which made him the more haughty. He would always be condemning the poor people in their sickness." They were obviously seasick first time.
Mm-hmm.
"And coming to them daily with grievous exhortations and did not let to tell them that he hoped to help cast half of them overboard before they came to the journey's end and to make merry with what they had. And if he were gently reproved by anyone, he would curse and swear most bitterly. But it pleased God, before they came half the seas over, to smite the young man with a grievous disease of which he died in a desperate manner, and so was himself the first that was thrown overboard.
Wow.
Thus, his curses fell upon his own head, and it was an astonishment to all his fellows, for they noted it to be the just hand of God upon him.
Sort of a Jonah story, yeah?
Sort of. But think about these poor passengers. 102 of them crowded in a very small area on the ship. It was an incredibly difficult voyage.
How many days is it?
66 days. Mm. And that's just to get them to the tip of Cape Cod in America. And it's another 20 plus days before they get to Plymouth, because they're exploring Cape Cod and having interactions and arrows shot by some of the indigenous people at the party. Right. You know, things like that. So it was not an easy transition. And then, of course, the tragic circumstances of the first winter, because they didn't start getting off the ship until December 25 of 1620.
Yeah, I remember it being December, but I didn't realize it was Christmas Day.
Exactly. And, of course, the Puritans, per se, did not celebrate Christmas Day as we do now.
Right.
So, unfortunately, as they're getting off the ship, a horrendous winter comes in. And between the 102 passengers getting off the ship, building homes during the first winter, only 51 of them survive.
Wow.
Half die in the first winter, including crew members on the Mayflower that are anchored in the harbor. And then the Mayflower turns around and goes back to London. Now, you can imagine what the reports were to the investor group. About half the group is already gone. Mm. And what's interesting is the Londoners, and I just got back from a trip to London, and I met another author who has written the book Mayflower in Britain, and he is very adamant that the English folks consider the Mayflower not to be a single voyage, but an expedition of three or four ships that then serviced the rest of the colony to get them through their horrific startup time. William Collier was signing letters on behalf of the investor group to Governor Bradford, and these letters are heartwarming. They pour their heart out about the difficulties they're having and how much support they want to provide them. They were very much caring for them from across the ocean.
So you might hear this story and somebody might think, well, they're just in it for the investment. They want their money back. And of course, that's the case. But it seems like there's also some pastoral care and genuine concern for these people's livelihood.
Yes. And I quote several of the letters because you can get a much better sense if you read the actual letters that were being exchanged between London and Plymouth. They are really a true partnerships. And yes, it's difficult for both sides because the first 3 or 4 years, no supplies came back to London because they were all pirated and they lost all of their investment and commodities. So the investor group for the first 4 years got no return on their investment whatsoever and continued supplying Plymouth.
Now, your ancestors survived the journey and the atrocious winter?
Yes, very much. And both of them became prominent citizens in the Plymouth colony. Stephen Hopkins is very well known. His daughter, Constance, was viewed not only as intelligent, but a beauty as well. And one of the most fun things I've ever done is going to the Pilgrim Hall Museum and seeing my ancestors, Constance Hopkins' hat. In the Pilgrim Hall Museum. Wow. It's still there today.
Why was his wife not with him?
Hopkins' first wife died when he was in Jamestown. And when he got notified, he actually left Jamestown on the first ship available, which happened to be the ship bringing Pocahontas to England. So Hopkins had three or four children with his first wife who died. He comes back to England. He remarries in London another lady by the name of Elizabeth, and they have some children together. And in fact, Elizabeth has a baby on the Mayflower.
Oh, forgive me. I didn't think any of his wives made the journey with him and the daughter.
The second wife did.
Oh, okay.
And I love the name of the baby, Oceanus.
Oh, that rings a bell.
Yeah, Oceanus was born on the Mayflower.
How many years pass before Mr. Collier and Jane make it to the New World?
13 after the Mayflower. What's very interesting is their final child was born in a different parish in what is today the Southwark Cathedral.
Yes.
The second largest cathedral in all of London.
Where Lancelot Andrews is.
That's right. Lancelot Andrews is buried in there, as well as the brother of Shakespeare, Edmund Shakespeare, is buried in that chancel. In fact, William Shakespeare is said to have paid some money so the bell would ring at noon when his brother's burial occurred in 1607. And that brings up another little point. The reason Collier's last daughter was baptized in that major cathedral is because he had a new business venture going on. He was known to have invested in a brew house. Well, when you think about blood sports going on, having a brew house and theaters around there, there was a little theater that most people would have some name recognition called the Globe.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
Okay, well, next to the Globe is a tavern called the Globe Tavern. Guess what brew house my ancestor invested in? It was the Globe Tavern.
So he didn't run it, but he was an investor.
He was actually living in right next to it. So he was an active investor.
Oh, I see.
He was a partner in it with another man.
So with all these things going on, why does Collier leave London? Is it the fire that you mentioned? They just finally had enough?
I don't think that's the only thing, because there was a lot of turmoil at this time in London with King James passing away and his son Charles I ascending to the throne in 1625.
The winds are changing.
The winds are changing, and the taxes started going up, and Charles dismissed Parliament several times.
Right.
So there was huge political, which created economic turmoil for the merchants.
And did Collier leave before the Civil War?
Yes, he did. Yeah, the Civil War didn't start until 1641.
Oh, okay.
But there was this huge crescendo of pushback against what Charles I was doing, which ultimately, after the Civil War, resulted in the execution of Charles I.
Yeah.
I mean, pretty big deal.
Yeah.
Pretty first monarch I'm aware of being executed.
Bill, in our remaining moments, and we want to make sure that we take time to tell people how they can get a copy of the book, but in our remaining moments, let's just kind of underscore now two parts of the family which are living over here in the New World. They're important parts of the Plymouth community. It's almost Thanksgiving time here when we're recording this, so this kind of thing is on everybody's mind.
Yeah.
Let's just finish off with the Hopkins and the Colliers. What are they doing? How are they doing? What's their life like now?
At the very first Thanksgiving, one of the interesting things I always like to cite is Constance Hopkins, I believe she's 15 at this time, is one of a handful of women who's actually serving at the first Thanksgiving meal.
And is it in the following fall?
The following fall is when the first Thanksgiving in 1621.
Right.
There are only a handful of women who are even of an age to be able to help serve the meal. And so she's, from the beginning, very important in Plymouth. Stephen becomes an assistant governor as well. He ultimately has a tavern He occasionally gets in trouble with serving too much alcohol to some of his people and, you know, is disciplined along the way. But he lives a good two decades and is very active in the leadership part of the community.
As is Collier when they arrive. And what year do they arrive?
They arrive in 1633, okay. But there's an overlap of a good 15 years or so before Hopkins passes away. Mm. But when Collier arrives, immediately Governor Bradford asks him to be an assistant, and he starts working on laws, writing laws, sitting on juries, and then he becomes a freeman, and then he's elected. Collier also negotiates the end of the deal with the investor group back in London.
Very interesting.
And he also is one of the two Plymouth colonists to be part of what becomes a committee to form the United Confederation of Colonies.
Did that ever bear any fruit?
Well, it did, because at that point there were only four or five colonies in New England, but they banded together in a government of sorts. And what's interesting is some people do point to that as a precursor of what became the British colonies, which ultimately became the 13 colonies that formed America.
Good gracious.
I mean, my goodness, this is big history.
Here. It is. I said in the last podcast that, and I was being silly, that the Cole family is at the epicenter of all things Western, Western history. But there's a little bit of truth in that.
Well, you know, when you think about it, Cole and Clark, who married Collier, and Collier himself are all significant family names in Plymouth Colony.
You know what this means, Bill?
Yeah.
It means you're going to have to do another book.
Oh, boy. You'll have to talk to Christy about that one. She's a little bit tired of watching me.
No, I'm sure. And the first time she hears this right now, she's shaking her head and saying,
probably.
No.
Probably. But I am working on some articles right now, and I think I'll start there, is to begin publishing some articles about what happens in America in more detail with these groups.
Did they live out their lives happily ever after?
They did. They did. And in fact, Daniel and Ruth Collier, who became Daniel's wife, they had 11 children. 10 of them had children. One of the children married but didn't have children. So there are a ton of Cole descendants, including me. And Ruth and Daniel Cole are my 8th great-grandparents.
I can imagine that it was not only interesting on a technical level to sort all this out, but Bill, I'm going to ask you to wax philosophically a moment. Mm-hmm. Not only the technical aspect of this, but what was it like getting to know these people and seeing what they did, and what does that do to your faith in family and in God?
Boy, big question. The first discovery I made was this Ruth Collier being baptized in Suffolk. And I will tell you, I was in front of my computer late at night, and when I saw her pop up on a record and I recognized that it was the unknown Ruth who married Daniel Cole, I shouted at the top of my lungs, Eureka! I have found it! Yeah. And all of a sudden, I'm getting to know these people at a personal level because I'm seeing what they did and the trials and tribulations and the challenges they faced and the plague survivals and all of this
and
stuff.
Fires and religious persecution.
All of those things. And you think, what remarkable fortitude and faith did they have?
Yeah. It's got to be encouraging.
It is encouraging to me, because I think there must be something in the spiritual dimension that passes along that from generation to generation. And I see that in my family more and more. And my faith has grown getting to know what they went through to make the choices that they did, to survive the trials and tribulations that they did, to adventure across the ocean when it was hardly even known that there were things like hurricanes.
Right.
but what they had to go through to become the people that they were on a brand new continent is so encouraging. And I just have a tremendous amount of admiration, not just for my ancestors, but for everyone that made that trip and made that kind of travel and made that kind of a commitment, primarily because of not only the religious freedom aspect to worship God in the way that they felt called, but to also have a chance that they never had in England. People could not own land or property in England. It was given to them by the king. They couldn't earn their own right to have property. In America, everyone had that right. That was one of the big draws for the original Plymouth colonists as well.
Well, it's an important foundational part of the American story, and mm-hmm. in some ways we're all tied to it. Mm-hmm. Bill, before we sign off, I want to make sure that people know what the title of the book is. Let's remind them of that, and let's remind them of the ways that they can get it, because they're going to want to read it.
Sure. The title of the book is Puritans, Plagues, and Promises. It is readily accessible on Amazon. Just type in the title of the book, and you'll find it. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and Kindle versions right now. There are also books available at the Pilgrim Hall Museum, and if you go onto their website, you can order a book directly from them. And if you want an autographed softcover copy of the book, then send me a note through my website, which is passionategenealogist.org. And send me a note that you're interested. I'll reserve one for you and give you the details at that point.
It occurred to me, Bill, that at this year's Thanksgiving, which will be the first after the book has come out, mm-hmm. no matter where you are and what you're eating, you ought to set a few empty spots mm-hmm. for those ancestors. Mm. One day there's going to be a great feast,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
In a new heavens and a new earth, and we're going to sit down at table and eat. Until then, it's neat to be reunited with them. Yeah. Of course, we do that when we come around the table of the Lord, but maybe set a place for them and a piece of pumpkin pie.
Sounds good.
Bill, it's a blessing to have you, and I'm so grateful that you took the time. Thanks again.
Thank you, Chris.
Folks, until we gather again for another episode of Ancient Future Faith, I want you to think about it, and actually, I want you to do more than that. I want you to ponder it carefully. Surely, the road to our Christian future must run through our ancient Christian past. Till next time, the Lord be with you.